I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington, editor-in-chief of The Spool and a senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
And I am Nathan Raven of Nathan Raven's Happy Place. I've also written two books recently, The Weird According to Alan Postal, and I am the co-host of the podcast you are listening to right now.
Indeed. And we have a very special guest with us, a holdover from the first iteration of the show before we pivoted. We pivoted in the best way. Steven Sadek of We Hate Movies. Hello, Steven.
Yeah, doing okay. This has been a long time in the making. I've gotten married in this time. You guys have changed formats. The world has started to crumble in this time, or continued to crumble, or maybe the speed at which the world is crumbling has increased.
Yes, we're in month three of crumble.
Gotcha.
We're a streusel at this point.
At the risk of plagiarizing, this whole world is wild at heart and weird on top.
It is.
Yes. For those of you who are just joining us for our first episode, this is a podcast where we're going chronologically through the careers of John Travolta and Nicolas Cage and sort of seeing where their careers parallel, and in this case, wildly differ. We are definitely in that stage. I think this is a really great case study for like where Travolta and Cage are at, just sort of at their essence. Because on the one hand, you have Wild at Heart, a David Lynch movie that's balls to the wall, pure Lynch with a manic Nick Cage performance at the center. And on the other, you have Dave Thomas's The Experts, which is like an SCTV adjacent Cold War comedy starring John Travolta and Ari Gross.
Yeah, it's a Bill Murray scraps is what it is.
Yeah, it's even got like a lesser Murray in it.
No, oh my God.
Well, not a lesser, a differently talented Murray.
I object vociferously to the idea.
No, I also love Brian Doyle Murray.
I'm actually I've stated publicly that I think that he is the greatest of all the Murray brothers.
Wow.
He's underrated. I mean, come on, the guy wrote Caddyshack. He was in Caddyshack. I mean, my God, you look at his career and the man is a marvel, and he's really good in this ridiculous, incredibly stupid movie as well that we're not going to talk about for a while because it's friggin' The Experts. And then also, so talking about, you know, where they were, like literally when David Lynch made Wild at Heart, he was the hottest creator in all of the world. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He won the Palme d'Or. And then The Experts sat on a shelf for 2 years and then waited for the Cold War to officially be over so it could be more irrelevant than anybody could possibly imagine.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. I can't, they're two films of different levels of value, let's say. I don't even think they're like, I mean, not, they're not equivalent in any way, but it's not like it's a, you know, a masterpiece and a total turd. There's like a weird amount of charm, I think, to The Experts that we'll talk about.
I will say if we're drawing comparisons, I don't think any scene in Wild at Heart could be in The Experts, but I do think that the dance scene in The Experts could be in Wild at Heart. Like, absolutely.
I refuse to believe that Quentin Tarantino had not seen that scene before casting him in Pulp Fiction, which we'll talk about.
But although it is interesting that Nicolas Cage sings in Wild at Heart and John Travolta, a top 40 recording artist, does not, but dances a lot, which again is another one of those redeeming facets.
Dances in heavy quotes.
he boogies, you know. It's one of those things where like, well, he dances a lot, but we can't afford a choreographer. So just do what moves you, okay? Like, pretend you're on MTV.
There are just scenes where he is just bopping to nothing, and like, yeah, like in, especially like the montages, which there are copious amounts of because they just need to like pass the time, and the movie is obviously cut to ribbons. It's just him like bopping around this club, and I'm like, what are you even doing?
Yeah, this is very much a matter of John Travolta amusing himself, and also, what do people like? People like when John Travolta dances.
That's right.
And I'm one of those people who likes him dancing. Again, not enough to save a motion picture like The Experts.
No, for sure. So yeah, we'll talk about both those motion pictures aplenty. But before we do, I want to remind everyone that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. Times is hard right now, as they always are. So if you want to feel like throwing us a buck or two to help us keep the lights on, that would be fantastic. So which movie do we want to start with, guys?
Well, let's start with Wild at Heart.
Let's start with Wild at Heart.
Both of us have seen it very, very recently. I think it's kind of fresh in our minds.
Can I talk to Lula?
You are not going to see him ever.
Like hell. I'd go the far end of the world for you, baby.
A man can't ask for more than that.
You move me, Sal. You really do.
You want me to shoot Sailor in the brains with a gun?
Uh-oh.
World, wild at heart and weird on top.
A movie that is remarkably difficult to find for being a Palme d'Or winner and an entry in the filmography of one of our greatest filmmakers.
I think there's some rights issues and stuff and blah, blah, blah. I mean,
yeah.
Anytime you see propaganda films and Polygram Entertainment, you're like, I don't know where this movie's going to end up.
Yeah, very, very true.
Was there like a Shout Factory Blu-ray or DVD of this? I have vague memories of there being
maybe
a really cool disc,
but in our COVID world, it's very difficult to find on streaming. You can't even rent it on VOD, which is very
it's insane.
Yeah, it's
well,
very,
it's not very cinematic. You don't really need to see it on a big screen.
You can watch it on your nice phone. It's fine.
It's like Quibi, you know, David Lynch or Judge Christine.
Did y'all see that Katzenberg profile where it's like, man, the coronavirus really hit Quibi hard? I'm like, yeah, a point where everyone is stuck in their homes is a real bad time for a streaming service to come out.
It's such a total cop out. It's amazing. Yeah, exactly. Like, but also, I guess his thing is like, well, you know, the millennials would be on the go normally, and you know, in their go-go world, they would be, you know, lifting weights and watching a 5-minute terrible. Fucking Twilight Zone knockoff,
yeah,
and then move on,
or watching right. 5 minutes of a Liam Hemsworth version of The World's Most Dangerous Game. Come on, it doesn't even have Ice-T or Gary Busey in it. Oh, good. I feel like it's going to go the way of CISO, in part because their names are destiny. Like, nothing called Quibi or CISO is going to fucking succeed in any universe.
If your streaming service sounds like a Teletubby,
yes.
It's not going to work.
Snorted some of that Quibi, then I finished off with some CISO. Oh,
things aren't looking good at Tubi TV, actually, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
I'm loving the idea of David Lynch having his own Quibi show.
Oh, my God, I would love it. What would it be called?
Oh God, it would be like Sand Movie.
No, it would be Twippy, which is short for Twin Peaks.
I would definitely sign up for Quibi to watch it.
Would be an on the air reboot, the TV show that he did that nobody remembers because it wasn't very good.
Oh, that's a shame. But this is pretty good. This is wild and hallucinogenic and feverish, just like all the best David Lynch stuff ought to be. Nathan, do you want to talk us through Wild at Heart?
Sure. But I think you guys are both substantially younger than me. Yeah, so you guys might not remember what a big pop culture event this was, because this hit right when David Lynch had done Twin Peaks. And Twin Peaks revolutionized television. It was kind of hard to overstate how important it was, how big it was, how it turned this very, very bizarre cult filmmaker into, I don't know, almost like a figure of Steven Spielberg level visibility. So he was so incredibly hot at this moment. He could basically do whatever he wanted to do.
He had fully recovered from Dune.
Yes, yes. Oh my God. Well, you know, again, he had Blue Velvet, which is, you know, considered a transcendent upper echelon of cult movies. And then he did Twin Peaks. And this weird soap opera had catapulted him to like this new level of fame and relevance. And he kind of used that leverage to make the craziest fucking movie ever. A movie that's crazy even by David Lynch standards. And yeah, this won the Palme d'Or, which is astonishing because it's such a bizarre, such a weird, such a ferociously American motion picture. And when it won the Palme d'Or, people booed. There was sustained booing. This is also one of those movies where there were a lot of walkouts and people were physically repulsed by a lot of what's going on with it. And it's an adaptation of a novel by a guy named Barry Gifford, who's kind of a contemporary neo-noir sort of fellow. And it's a very fascinating combination of these two aesthetics meeting and mutating into this really bizarre, weird, utterly distinctive motion picture. Do you want to talk a little bit about the plot there, Mr. Worthington?
Sure. The plot, such as it is essentially this road
well,
movie.
Well, it's a very hard-boiled neo-noir plot.
Yeah. You know,
it's relatively, like, as bizarre and weird as this movie is, in a lot of ways, the plot is relatively straightforward.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's essentially, it follows these two lovers, Sailor Ripley and Lula, played by Nicolas Cage, and Perpetual Lynch siren Laura Dern.
Mute.
Who... Yes. Who sort of reunite after Sailor spends a few years in jail after beating a man to death for attacking him with a knife. Yeah. Who had apparently been hired by Lula's mother, played by Diane Ladd, which we will get into.
First of all, pro tip, when you're about to murder someone in cold blood in public for some reason, don't announce it to the guy right as you're about to do it. When the knife is in his heart, then you can be like, dude, I'm killing you.
I know.
Oh. Well, he stopped short of writing in the man's blood, "I just killed you." That's like the only act of mercy that he showed. And again, I feel like this is kind of important to talk about this because there are a lot of from the vantage point of 2020, a lot of very problematic elements of this, one of which is that it begins with our hero, sort of in quotation marks, sort of anti-hero, not only killing a black man, but killing him in a way that is egregiously, unnecessarily, gratuitously violent. Like, yes, this man says, "Hey, I'm supposed to kill you. How about that? Here's a knife." And then Sailor is like, "Okay, I will do the most violent thing I can possibly do." Like, he turns into hamburger meat just over and over and over and over. It begins as self-defense, and then it turns into manslaughter, and then it becomes very, very murdery.
Yep.
And again, this is an element of noir, is you're rooting for the bad guy. You're rooting for somebody who does something really, 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 really egregiously horrible. And one of the things that's fascinating and disturbing and weird about this is Nicolas Cage kills people. At the end, he's very, very willing to, like, he's like, "Hey, I'm out of jail. Time for me to abandon my family." And at the same time, he's kind of the good guy. And he's kind of the good guy because he's Nicolas Cage. And he's so sexy and so charismatic and so handsome and so charming. And yeah, it's like, should I hate this man with every fiber of my being? Should I have complicated feelings about him? But again, it's David Lynch, so it's all very transgressive. And it's all very who gives a fuck about your feelings.
Well, and also in the dark fairy tale of this movie, he is still, like, there are so many other characters that are so much worse than him, too. Like, there's, you know, Willem Dafoe's character and all of the scheming people, like, I don't know, Diane Ladd. And yeah, there's just a lot.
I watched this movie for the first time last night, which is kind of, I'm a Lynch guy insofar as I'm very pro Lynch, but I've not gone through his filmography because I don't like Nightmares that much. I mean, like, I've seen a ton of his movies and I loved all the Twin Peaks iterations, especially the last bit there on Showtime and all that stuff. And I really, really love it, but it's just not something I'm ever like, do you know what I'm really in the mood for right now? A David Lynch movie.
Yeah, it's a nice romp.
And that's something this morning that I read that sort of put the movie like, oh, okay, it's a love story. So it's two people who find love in hell. And that kind of makes sense because everything is so wretchedly awful, even
and
for
all
a
the hellish
property.
Flame imagery too. Well, like,
for
the credits,
sure.
Yeah. So long story short, he goes to prison. He comes back out. He and Lula sort of make a break for it so they can go off and, you know, be in love together. But
and
Diane Ladd.
Okay. We should state that they fuck. And then they fuck some more. And
they fuck a lot.
The essence of their relationship is that they love to fuck. And we love to watch them.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this
yeah.
is this is a very, like, this is one of the few erotic motion pictures that is genuinely erotic. That is, yep. like, genuinely sensual. Like, this is a sexy fucking picture. And it's interesting, too, because I feel like this is kind of the apex of Nicolas Cage's swaggering sexuality. Kind of the apex, too, of Nicolas Cage rocker.
Yes, and he's like fucking. He's
literally Elvis in this.
Yeah,
yeah. And I remember being like, "Oh, he doesn't just do an Elvis voice; he literally does Elvis."
Yeah,
and I remembered correctly. And it's one of the things where it's like I remember watching the audio commentary for "Confessions of a Dangerous Mind" and being kind of mixed on it to begin with, and then George Clooney in that very charming way of his basically talking about how every single scene was copied from a movie from the 1970s. And I was like, you know what? Like, my respect for this movie is lowered because you're not inspired by something. You're literally just co-opting something that you like.
Just aping it.
And
yeah.
again, Nicolas Cage, he gives an amazing, sexy, charismatic performance. He's also aping every part of Elvis Presley. Not just the voice, not just the swagger, not just the attitude. Like, he's playing Elvis Presley with Marilyn Monroe in Wizard of Oz, but with David Lynch,
or more potently, he's taking his Saturday Night Live Tiny Elvis character to the big screen. This was a large screen adaptation of his Tiny Elvis sketch.
Yeah. In more ways than one.
I'm pretty sure they came after.
It's little Elvis and big Elvis.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, and yet there is this element of metatextuality, of course, because the movie knows that you know the rhythms of like an Elvis Presley movie and of Wizard of Oz. Like that imagery is like front and center. It is unapologetic. I describe this movie as Blue Hawaii Velvet. And
I like that a lot.
Yeah, thank you. I was pretty proud of it for 8 a.m. but yeah, so there is this it's the way Lynch loves playing with that thin line between sort of wholesome Americana and the brutal sort of underbelly of it. It's very Blue Velvet. So there's this innocent love story that is also tinged with like murder and sexual assault, and the relationship itself is driven so much by just like carnal passion.
I do want to say, just because we're talking about Cage specifically, the opening of this movie is very much the opening of Con Air. I'm sorry, but it is.
Oh, yeah. I even, like, before I clocked it was Elvis, I was like, oh, that's his Cameron Poe voice. Yeah, it's pretty great. Yeah, he loves to, like, play characters who go into prison and then come out of prison and then have to like flee for their lives.
He does like 8 years total in this movie, which is nuts because he's involved in at least 3 murders. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, which is, I guess, a comment on Southern justice, but also just sort of, you know, dreamy David Lynch stuff. But it is kind of amazing. I did find it very helpful that
David Lynch informed us that Cape Fear is somewhere near the border between North and South Carolina.
Yeah.
That was very helpful of him. I appreciated it.
Well, I think it's worth saying that he literally gets away with murder because he has a handsome white man. He is a handsome, straight white man. And I think, you know, one of the big defining characteristics of this is the good people, the people you're supposed to root for, the people who are innocent, despite the incredibly horrible things they do, are really, really beautiful and sexy. Mm-hmm. And everybody else, even if they're attractive, like Kelvin Lockhart is like a very, very handsome man. Like, he's handsome in a sinister way and in a violent way, in a creepy, disturbing way. So yeah, there's kind of the good people are coded as being very, very attractive. And then using their fucking and their sexuality for good and to help the world and to express their love and desire. And the other people use sex because they're evil, and it's a disturbing, monstrous, kind of satanic force in a lot of ways. That's one of the many weird, complicated, problematic elements of this, is that it's both pro-sex and very anti-sex.
Yes.
It has incredibly complicated sideways feelings about sex, and it expresses them in bizarre and extreme and troubling ways.
Right, and it's also so difficult sometimes for me to, like, get that sort of, that moral angle on it too, because Lynch's films feel like they exist in a universe all their own where there is no moral compass.
But at the same time, morality is incredibly important. I mean, again,
of course,
you know, Blue Velvet, you know, with Laura Dern, who's this cartoon of virginal innocence. And that's one of the things that was kind of crazy about this. I remember when it came out, seeing it in the theater and being like, oh, this is, you know, the incendiary Palme d'Or winning masterpiece from our greatest living filmmaker, and being like, this movie is fucking ridiculous. You know, this is a cartoon. This is Southern Gothic. This is Southern trash. This is kind of John Waters' Wizard of Oz.
Yes. Yes.
Is what it kind of felt like to me. And yeah, John Waters wouldn't be out of place in here. I kind of felt like Willem Dafoe's mustache was a bit of an homage to John Waters. Because again, there's just this over-the-top vulgarity to this where, yeah, it's kind of a comic book. It's an art film and it's incendiary. But it's also like this bizarre comic book with this, you know, extreme everything.
I do think that there's also this weird thing where it doesn't actually go off the Lynchian narrative cliff, though. Like, it does, like we said earlier, like kind of follow it because it's adapted from a book, and also all sorts of reasons. It stays on a very specific kind of road, and it goes back, and it's very clean in that way, which is weird because it's not like somebody's turning into a different character or somebody goes into a transmeditative state and like everything else after that is suspect or so on and so forth. It's really just, it's pretty straightforward, which actually makes it kind of more disturbing because it makes it in a quote unquote real world, if that makes sense.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think the road movie pattern helps it stay along a certain plot trajectory, even if it takes all these Lynchian detours.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the plot. So they go out on the road, and they're being pursued by her mother, who is played by Diane Ladd, who is a great, great, great character actress who sort of specialized in playing characters who are fucking nuts. We're very big, very extreme. You know, they're kind of, yeah, great old actresses like Shirley Knight did that, Shelley Winters, who just have this amazing, amazing over-the-top presence. And she wants to fuck Sailor Ripley. And we've talked a lot about over the course of this of this podcast, how sexy Nicolas Cage was as a young actor, but also how defined he was by his sexuality. And that definitely is the case here, where kind of one of the catalysts is she's like, you know, do you want to fuck your girlfriend's mama?
He's like, oh, this mama, I'm sorry, ma'am, like to fuck you.
It's like a peanut butter and a banana sandwich, but I'm not gonna have sex with my mother's with my wife's mother.
Well, he does say, oh, no, ma'am, I sure won't. You know, which is like,
yeah, no, like, no, ma'am, exactly.
He literally calls her Miss Fortune.
Yes.
He does indeed. So she kind of, she has these incredibly sexual powers of her own, and she kind of sends these men who are in love or enraptured with her to go and to kill Sailor and Laura Dern's character, who, again, is just, I feel like she's perpetually on the verge of an orgasm. You know, that's kind of the sexuality that she brings to it, which just, it's so incendiary and so hot and so not even on the verge of being over the top and on the verge of being cartoonish and campy. It's campy. It's cartoon. It is incredibly over the top.
It's a pure camp performance, yeah.
It is, indeed. And there are so many weird performances in this movie, and I think maybe my favorite is Harry Dean Stanton, because he plays a normal person. He plays somebody who doesn't do anything bizarre. He doesn't do anything irrational. He's like, okay, I'm, you know, I have this thing that I have to do, and I will go about it in a sane, reasonable way. And within this context, that is so weird and so fascinating and has such personality and its texture and depth to it. Like, yeah, I was blown away by, again, just kind of the weird decency.
Well, his function is to just be like, do not involve this other guy, J.E. Freeman, who is going to destroy everything with his hounds of hell. Like, I could just kind of get in a car and do some PI work. We can go to a nice dinner and we can have like regular-ish sex, if that's okay.
It was wild to see J.E. Freeman show up in this because I mostly know him from Alien Resurrection. As like the weird mad scientist there. So yeah, it's always nice to see his sort of like weird skeletal intensity show up.
Do you guys enjoy Crispin Glover and the Crispin Gloveriest performance?
I'm making my lunch. Yeah, it's great.
He literally is just cast as a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
question mark, exclamation point.
It's just like, I do love that the movie takes a minute, like, you think this is crazy? Here's an anecdote about somebody putting cockroaches up their ass. And thematically, not so much important, but, you know, it's Crispin Glover. And David Lynch will always sneak a short film into an into a major motion picture for sure.
And you talk about the devil being in the details. Literally, the incredibly disturbing shots of once they establish that Crispin Glover's character, the crazy cousin, who's kind of a cautionary tale of, I guess, what happens with bad ideas. He likes to put cockroaches in his underwear. And then we get a sense of, okay, they're going into yes. various crevices, and they're making him very happy by doing so. And I don't want to kink shame, but we're getting into bestiality with cockroaches. I'm prepared to draw the line there. But again, he just commits to it wholeheartedly. There are such bizarre cameos in this.
Like the Freddie Jones one where he shows up with like a Donald Duck voice or whatever.
I did not realize that Freddie Jones is Toby Jones' dad.
Oh, really? Did you know that absolutely makes sense once you say that, yeah.
I hope for the love of God that Crispin Glover didn't feel compelled to find out what that's like. You know what I mean? Like,
didn't go method for this.
Most actors, you could say, hey, your character does this crazy thing. You're like, okay, weird. But Crispin Glover, he's got a long weekend. You know what I mean? Call time is Monday, 8 a.m. He's like, I want to get it. I really want to get it.
Yeah.
Well, you think about what Nicolas Cage did with a cockroach just a movie ago. You don't want to, two movies ago, actually. But yeah, I would not want him to go as method as Nicolas Cage did here. I was actually looking on IMDb trivia, and one of the things they said that this taught Nicolas Cage to be less method because of how crazy his characters were. And apparently, David Lynch would just rewrite the script on the spot. So he just kind of had to run with things. And yeah, I think probably David Lynch looked at the script and was like, this isn't crazy enough. There aren't enough crazy characters and not much weird crap going on. Need to just throw it all to the wall.
It is kind of weird like to watch Nicolas Cage butt up against Lynch in this. I mean, and again, like he's in the movie, he's perfect for the movie, and like the movie doesn't work without him and all that stuff. But like, it's not exactly Roger Rabbit where it's a real character in a cartoon world. It's almost as if like anytime you'd watch like in the 1992 Aladdin when there's a CGI cartoon on top of an actual cartoon.
Real quick, I'm so sad that you have to specify which Aladdin it is.
Oh, yeah. The 1992 Aladdin. Disney's original cartoon Aladdin. Like when there's this, when you see like the CGI, the real cartoon, what do you call it there, flying carpet against like a CGI lava, that's kind of what Nicolas Cage is in this world. It's like, it's a layering
of two different blends of crazy clashing a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really
interacting with each other, at least, yeah. And then also, you know, in addition to the Elvis stuff, again, like there's all the overt Wizard of Oz imagery. There's like literal transitions where like a wicked witch is looking at the events through the seeing eyeball, and there's the, you know, Laura Dern clicking her heels together, that kind of stuff.
Well, I love also that they established this as very inspired by Wizard of Oz, kind of a crazy, surrealistic riff on Wizard of Oz by constantly referencing Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. I'm telling you, your wife,
she's just like the Wizard of Oz. She's like, you know, the evil, and yeah, the dog is going to be just like Toto. It's Jack Nance. He says, I have a dog. You do not know what kind of dog I have. You might think the dog that I have is named Toto from the Wizard of Oz. And again, that's not that subtle and artful when you're literally just saying, hey, this is just like that thing that we're inspired by.
But it is that thing where like it's that Lynch thing where like it's out in the world, so it's part of everything anyway, so like we're talking about it and it's also destroying us at the same time.
Yeah, a little bit, like it becomes so overt that that overtness becomes part of the sort of metatext. Which I love. And then there's Glinda the Good Witch showing up at the end and that kind of shit.
Yeah, played by Cheryl Lee. And that's another thing that was kind of fascinating and weird and interesting is how many parallels there are to Twin Peaks. It feels like Twin Peaks is penetrating the film at various points, where it's kind of like meshing and fusing and kind of becoming the same weird sort of thing.
It's just so hallucinogenic and so crazy. So like by the time you're sort of getting settled with Nick Cage and Laura Dern in Big Tuna, which unfortunately in my quarantine brain, I just constantly thought of The Office.
Yes.
And then cutting back to Diane Ladd with like a completely red lipstick face, just going completely insane in her bathroom. And I'm just sort of like, yes, this is Lynch. Put it in my veins.
It is that whole, I mean, Diane Ladd was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. She never had a chance, let's be honest. But like, it's well met because she is phenomenal in this movie. And every single syllable is uncomfortable. It comes from another place. And the unhinged I do love that there's this part of her that, like, she does realize that Harry Dean Stanton is, like, the good side of her, and J.E. Freeman is this nightmare thing that she has to touch, and, like, that moment when she realizes that she's done it wrong is she bathes herself in red lipstick and then has a kind of a sweet call to save her, to try and save Harry Dean Stanton's life. The friction is so insane.
Well, there's this utter fearlessness in her performance and then in Laura Dern's performance as well, where I feel like you cannot say enough good things about Laura Dern. Like, she's so charismatic. She's so forceful. She has such agency. And it's complicated, very, very complicated as well. But yeah, I was blown away by this performance, which again is just so bold and so extreme and so unapologetic in its frankness and its candor and its incendiary sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that does not have any subtext. It leaves it all out on the table in all of its craziness. Like, there are lines where Nick Cage will literally tell you that his snakeskin jacket represents a symbol of his individuality and his personal freedom.
The exact line is, this is a snakeskin jacket, and for me, it's a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom. And the great thing about that is Nicolas Cage's own snakeskin jacket. Really? He brought it to the film. Apparently, it was an homage to Marlon Brando in The Fugitive Kind. There are moments where they're like, wow, this guy's a lot like Elvis Presley. And then he will literally – another weird element of this is that it's really into heavy metal.
Yes.
It's really into crappy heavy metal.
It's into one specific heavy metal riff in particular.
Yeah, pretty much. Or just the idea of heavy metal more than it is into like actual heavy metal music. He will be like, oh, you guys remind me a lot of E. You have the same power as E does. Then he's like, I'm going to sing an Elvis Presley song. Like, that's one of the things that gets her really hot and bothered is when he sings Love Me Tender.
I do think the two coolest times Nicolas Cage existed are in this movie. One is when he's moshing in the metal club and doing high kicks to everybody. Two is when he does a forward flip out of the car to again mosh on the side of the road. I'm like,
Well, and the high kicks are great too because they're Nicolas Cage high kicks. There's that wonderful clip of him being on that Japanese talk show, and he like runs onto the stage and does a bunch of kicks and like starts throwing out cards and whatnot, being Nicolas Cage. That is Nicolas Cage-iest. And then also, that's Elvis Presley. Like, his style of dancing involved doing a lot of karate. He's like, I'm not going to learn all this karate if I can't implement it into my dancing as well.
It does make me wish that he did a comic book movie earlier than that shitty Ghost Rider movie. Like, if he did some 90s whatever around here, which I'm sure he would have loved to have done.
Nicolas Cage for Reed Richards.
Exactly. Or even like, I don't even know, Iron Fist or something. Some nightmare thing. Some nightmare 90s version of Iron Fist.
Some canon version of Iron Fist.
Exactly.
Oh God, I want it now.
Directed by Albert Pyun.
Exactly. He's Iron Fist, like only in name only, kind of. He wears the costume in like half of a scene, but it's awesome.
This reminded me a little of Jim Thompson, partially in this idea of this town that is just hell, you know, that you kind of find yourself in this place. And we sort of talk about conventional morality kind of permeates this sort of weird amoral movie. I think, you know, the fact that Sailor and his girl, she gets pregnant. And again, you know, within the context of the American dream, like that's what happens. You find the girl and they get pregnant and then you build a life together. To help finance this, they go on one last heist. And it is engineered by a guy named Bobby Peru.
Willem
Dafoe. Oh, my God. So I think, would you guys like to talk a little bit about Willem Dafoe at possibly his creepiest performance?
Yes. It's aided, obviously, by those grotesque dentures that are like just that. Delights in doing big close-ups on just these like diseased, rotten-looking nubs of teeth that he's like just mashing through as he like just leers. It's like a peak sort of villainous Willem Dafoe performance.
I also love he's introduced when we're just in a trailer park where they're kind of cooling their heels. They ran out of money. They're just, you know, Laura Dern is throwing up because she's pregnant. So they're just kind of hanging out with all these dudes, Pruitt Taylor Vince and John Lurie. Also great. And like, I love that their idea is like, everything is fucking hilarious. Like, yeah, everyone's a nightmare. Someone's filming, which is my favorite line in the movie, a Texas-style porno three trailers down,
What does that mean?
I have no idea. I love it. I guess chili is involved, I'm guessing.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, boy. Yeah, it's like a Frito pie. I don't know. I don't want to know what a Frito pie would be in terms of sexual maneuvers.
And that's when DeVoe shows up, and he's just it's such a bizarre performance, and so it's I love how understated it is, because he's just letting his physicality make you want to vomit, and like, just he's kind of like almost boyish and silly in this nightmare world. Like when he talks about how he's gonna make a big noise in the toilet, it's like, my lord.
Yeah. And even his sort of sexual assault of Laura Dern is just this weird extended bluff.
Yes.
Where he terrorizes her but doesn't actually do the deed and backs away, and that's somehow even more haunting and shocking that he didn't even do it. He just needed to like have that power over her. Lynch delights in showing us sort of just the praying mantis nature of Willem Dafoe, like at all times.
Yeah, he's a well, first of all, he's a veteran, so thank you for your service.
Yes. Like a lot of late period cage roles.
It also takes place in New Orleans, like a lot of Nicolas Cage roles as well.
True. I wonder if Bobby Peru and his character from Grand Isle would have gotten along.
I think so. I think so. They're both creepy, creepy, reprehensible. And again, I think this is kind of another neo-noir staple, which is the ill-fated robbery, and then the character who is vaguely well-intentioned but very stupid, and doesn't mind doing a lot of crimes, and doing them very, very badly.
I do love how Isabella Rossellini just drives out of the movie. She's just like, honk, honk, get me out of here.
Bleach blonde Isabella Rossellini, yes. Which is a look, an L-E-W-K look.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so much of the early 90s style here. There's so much fucking Chris Isaak on this score.
Yes.
Like, you could get one or two, but my lord, the amount of Chris Isaak on this.
Also, yes. There's a lot of Grace Zabriskie in yes. this, because, yeah, you can't have a disturbing David Lynch movie without a lot of... And I felt like she kind of has a similar look and a similar vibe to Isabella Rossellini.
Yes.
I found that a little bit... But then again, it's like there's Nicolas Cage, there's Laura Dern, and then there are 75 lunatics.
I do think, you know? I do think if you saw Grace Zabriskie in real life, you'd be like, oh, that's a nice-looking older woman. You know what I mean? Like, not a gorgeous, statuesque beauty, but like, oh, you know, an above average looking over older woman. But like, Lynch takes her to this, and she is so game for all of it, whatever this performance is, with the disability plus the voodoo such and such.
And again, this is the movie that they made. Apparently there was a scene where after Grace Zabriskie and Kelvin Lockhart, who was this great, really fascinating actor, he was in a movie called Cotton Comes to Harlem, really fantastic in that, but I don't think he has a single line of dialogue. He's just there to be this weird, interesting, dark figure. And apparently in the original cut of this, after they murdered Harry Dean Stanton, they had sex. And everybody in the audience walked out in horror. They're like, even for this movie, that's going way too far. So they're like, okay, we don't want to get an X rating. We don't want everybody in the world to flee in horror from this movie. So let's cut out that thing that goes just a little too far. Because I feel like that's the essence of this, is going too far. I also feel like this is, again, kind of a comic book movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do feel like I would love to be in the room when David Lynch is like, okay, that's too much. Got it. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
finally found the line. Thanks for letting me know. I had no idea.
Sometimes you touch a hot tea kettle and get burned. Got it.
let's talk a little bit about the ending of this motion picture.
Yeah.
Oh, because goodness, it has a heck of an ending.
A crackerjack ending. Yeah, he, you know, after sort of like an abrupt breakup, I guess, after he comes out of prison and he, or do we want to go to the robbery?
We can do the robbery.
Yeah, yeah. So like, you know, Nick Cage and Willem Dafoe, they do this robbery that Willem Dafoe's roped him into, but Bobby Peru has only given him dummy ammunition, and he's just going completely crazy, shooting everyone else. And making a break for it. There's a police officer who shoots him enough that Willem Dafoe accidentally blows his own head off with a shotgun.
It's kind of weird because it's almost like the platoon scene. You know what I mean? He gets shot, shot, and then, but oops, at the end, hilariously, his own head like goes flying like a football.
Womp womp. It's like some very violent slapstick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I feel like someone like looks at it and reacts, like says something about it. I don't remember what it was, but it was just funny.
And then meanwhile, while this is happening, one of the two guys who got shot inside of the feed store are running around trying to grab their own hand because one of the guys is like, oh, don't worry, man. You can just reattach those these days. And this adorable and hilarious dog is running away with this hand. A plus.
That's a good gag. And then we have a Bratz, the movie, like Time Jump, where Sailor Ripley
is the Rosetta Stone of cinema.
Sailor Ripley does another 5 years for the horrible felonies that he has committed. And then he comes back, and of course, you know, his woman is waiting for him with his boy, who has the world's worst mullet. I felt so bad for this little boy.
World's worst mullet on this episode of the podcast, we shouldn't be talking about.
That's true. He had a terrible blonde mullet there, and he's like, oh my goodness, it's good to see you all again. I guess it's time for me to abandon my family. Y'all take care now.
I do think that classic fuckboy excuse of I'm not good enough.
Oh, yeah, totally. I do think that before we stop talking about people's looks, I was shocked how much Cage looks like Jason Schwartzman in this. You know what I mean? Like that, the Coppola thing is always there, but you always kind of forget because he's from Mars and everyone else is from Italy. But like in this movie specifically,
Cages are from Mars, and Coppolas are from Italy.
Exactly. He looks like a taller Schwartzman. It was kind of bizarre to me.
You know, even speaking of weird things, you know who Diane Ladd and the Laura Dern's cousin is?
No.
Their cousin is Tennessee Williams.
Wow.
And if you look at Bruce Darley, I remember thinking, like, I think it was a while ago, I'm like, oh, he always plays scumbags and losers and monsters. Like, I wonder what his history is. So I went and looked up in Wikipedia, and he was like, from one of the most distinguished families in Illinois history, his godmother was Eleanor Roosevelt. Yeah, like, his dad was, like, a freaking senator. It's like this amazing, amazing political dynasty. And then, on the other side, you have Tennessee Williams. So it is perhaps not surprising that Laura Dern grew up to be an incredibly talented actress with an incredibly strong personality.
A deep intelligence.
I think we haven't really talked about the sexual chemistry between Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, which is fucking explosive.
It's dynamite.
That's the glue that kind of holds this film together. And yeah, apparently it went on a road trip because their conceptions were that they were two characters, basically, who are one person. They're like one person with two different bodies and two different identities.
Were they going out at this time in any way, shape, or form? I mean, not that, you know, that super matters, but it's always kind of interesting, especially like Cage's romantic career. And Laura Dern has also had a very prolific and interesting romantic career. I it wouldn't shock me one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that it was very important for them to get close, you know, and for it to have that kind of. And also, too, I mean, like, you look at Laura Dern, Smooth Talk. great movie. Have you guys seen that at all?
It's Treat
Williams. And there's a very precocious, complicated and sexuality to that as well. I mean, even going back to, like, you know, Lady and Gentleman of the Fabulous Stains. She has such so many different interesting elements of her on screen.
And the trust she must have for both Lynch and Cage to be able to let anyone get this close in all these different ways.
Yeah, well, she went against her no nudity clause in a very, very, very big way here.
Yes.
Although I thought it was interesting because, you know, we've seen Nicolas Cage's naked body a lot over the course of the last decade, and he's not naked here. You know, there are lots of artful scenes of them fucking, but they're always like his head.
There's always a strategic cover in between.
Yeah, and we also don't, the camera doesn't ogle him the way that it did in, you know, some of his earlier performances where it's like, look how freaking ripped this guy is.
Yeah.
It's more just like this guy has a swaggering sexuality and she's really into it.
Well, Lynch is always interested. I mean, he very much casts many sexy dudes, but it's the camera always kind of creeps on to whatever the lady's doing in this situation, you know what I mean? And whatever her lipstick might happen to be, specifically.
In Diane Ladd's case, all over her face.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, all of this stuff is fantastic. I know we're probably running long on Wild at Heart. Is there any other thoughts that we have on this one?
Well, just I think the part where he is beaten up by a group of punks at the very end there. And he calls him the F word, which apparently made it into the celluloid closet. And you're like, well, okay, maybe he wasn't specifically meaning that as a homophobic slur. And then when he, and then he visit, then he's visited by Glinda the Good Witch, played by Cheryl Lee. And again, this is like, this movie is fucking ridiculous. This is only slightly less of a Warner Brothers cartoon than like Raising Arizona was.
Yeah.
So he comes back and he's like, okay, maybe in order to be a good dude, I shouldn't abandon my family. And then he says, I also want to apologize for calling you a bunch of homosexuals. And part of it's like, well, I appreciate, but you are also specifying that you were specifically using that horrible word as a homophobic slur. But again, it's because Nicolas Cage is so inherently likable, even though he does all of these horrible, gross, terrible things. You know, it's hard not to have a certain sympathy for him.
Right. Well, as he says, travails. As he tells them, I'm a robber and a manslaughterer, and I haven't had any parental guidance.
Yeah, the parental guidance, like, it's, again, that's could be something out of Raising Arizona.
Also, if I'm mugging this guy, I am taking that jacket. I am sorry, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no one's leaving that thing behind. It's so, so great.
And also, those punks seem to be from, like, 1982.
Yes, exactly.
Like, there's this very weird time war element to this where ostensibly it takes place in 1990, but, you know, Nicolas Cage is from the 1950s.
Yeah.
Other things are from the 1960s. These punks were from, like, the late 70s. Like, this very weird, like, and again, intentionally surreal, intentionally bizarre. And we're talking about, like, oh, there's nothing, like, fantastical. Like, they're fucking witches in this movie.
Very great.
Like, that itself is pretty fucking fantastical. That's pretty, pretty surreal. It doesn't happen in movies that are not bonkers or, you know, a fantasy or science fiction on some level.
Right. Well, speaking of stories that exist in some kind of time warp, I feel like maybe that's a good segue to talk about.
Definitely.
The other film on our docket today, The Experts.
Americans, here in the most secret KGB complex in the world.
Deep in the heart of Russia.
Beyond the doors of this classroom, there is an exact replica of a town in the United States.
Two Americans have been abducted.
I'm going to bring in some experts on American culture and give this town the facelift it needs.
Two Americans who have no idea.
What are we doing in Wally in the Beef's bedroom?
That they're not in America.
I just got off a plane from New York where it's almost 1990. Here it's the 1950s.
We're going to run.
Now.
We're going to transform this nightmare.
They're going to show the Russians what's hip.
Blood. AB positive.
What's hot.
What's your name?
Bonnie, you knew us?
I forgot.
And what's happening?
The key to modern America is Japanese products.
Steadies, TZs, compact dicks.
Get out of town.
Now they're partying, they're having a great time, and they're making fun of us.
And they will be terminated.
Those are Russian army uniforms.
Probably just the Salvation Army, yeah.
Please. Gesundheit. What do we do now?
You need to be well hung like a Russian woman.
There's no time for sex games. I mean, you know, the gun, it's an exciting touch and everything.
They wanted authorities on American culture. Instead, they got the experts.
He still hasn't, like, he hasn't come back with, like, look who's talking, or, you know, at least in sort of the critical consensus. And so this is sort of a weird movie. Like you said, it was shelved for 2 years because I think they were going to, like, do reshoots. And but then by the time the reshoots wanted to happen, Travolta gained 30 pounds. So they were like, fuck it. But yeah, so it's Steven, do you want to give us the lowdown on, like, what The Experts is about?
Well, sure. Like, so if Wild at Heart is a love story set in hell, this is a Harold Ramis movie set in hell. It's kind of this weird, we open with this, like, weird ghost, specifically Ghostbusters-esque opening where it's this interview between Kelly Preston.
It's Stripes meets Footloose.
Yes, exactly. But wherein she's giving this job interview, and then is it Charles Murray is the guy's name, or
Charles Martin Smith
comes out
from American Graffiti
and The Untouchables and all sorts of great stuff.
Never Cry Wolf,
who plays the oh so helpful Mr. Smith in this. Yes, it's very easy to remember his character name.
You find out very quickly that she is a KGB asset that is trying to be American, but she just doesn't have the chops. And there is this bizarre bottle town in the middle of the Soviet Union, or is it in Japan or off the coast of Japan?
It's funny. The IMDb trivia specifies that, like, the description of the location is inaccurate. Which yeah. I love that someone took the time to do the calculations. But they say it's like in Russia, it's like 80 miles from the Sea of Japan, I guess.
Okay.
Well, we can also say that this is a line that kind of captures this film in its essence and is a take on 1987/1989 America. It's Charles Martin Smith. He's trying to poke holes in this agent because, you know, very good academically. You've read all the books. But he says, have you ever been aerobicized, slam danced? Do you listen to a ghetto blaster? Have you watched MTV? Give me five. So basically, within the context of this movie, that is America.
Yes.
Those six hackneyed slang terms that were also incredibly dated by 1989.
This was also the early days of sushi being popular in America, too. So the idea of eating raw fish was still like a gag-worthy...
You mean cooked fish, right?
From No. Yeah, it's raw.
Straight up raw.
Like fried?
We put it on rice.
No, baked? No. It's just raw with wrapped seaweed.
You're talking about like broiled?
You take the fish out of the ocean, you cut up the fish, you put it on some rice.
Oh, yeah, you go into this restaurant and this Japanese fella just cuts up all this raw fish and feeds it to you? Oh, that's not for me.
That's real weird.
It's this weird, and like that's kind of what, and basically you find out that this weird bottle town that is a KGB asset factory, but also has enough quote-unquote NPCs in it who just are supposed to live.
They're all walking around saying Orange Man bad. It's so strange.
That like have to live this bizarre life wherein they are only there to be American for these Russian assets to learn what America is. But it's stuck in like the early 1960s. And Charles
We're 1950s. 50s. Yeah, let's not give them too much credit. It's about 1950s. I've had sort of like Back to the Future.
Yes.
To the Future, there was like a village that was from 1955, except that it existed in the present. And in that way, it kind of reminded me a little bit of other movies with sort of similar premises, like The Village.
Yes.
Would be one. Another was Truman Show. I felt like this is the stupidest possible version of the Truman Show.
Yeah, basically. And that's what Brian Doyle Murray has been running for all these years. And Charles Martin Smith's like, no, MTV, MTV. We need to bring
punk rock. They mentioned punk rock a bunch of times. Also, they don't know what punk rock is.
Well, that's the most amazing thing. Is like Charles Martin Smith is right about this. I mean, he goes about it the wrong way. But it's like, this is, if you send these people from the 1950s into America, they're going to stick out like sore thumbs. The point is to make a real facsimile of America in this bizarre town. That's the whole point. And he's got like
half the people are old, so what do they know about, like, why do they care about having them know punk music?
And I also love that the dean of the Soviet Union is like, all right, everyone, you've got 30 days to turn this around. Which I always love.
Animal House.
You rowdy Ruskies.
Well, they're the snobs, and they need to recruit some slobs in order to teach them about America. And I like to think that what these two films share, beyond the stars of Face Off, is they're about America.
Yes.
And they're very weird, bizarre, specific versions of America. They kind they're of exist very, like, only Reagan-esque within themselves. Versions
of, like, the Ronald Reagan sort of deal is sort of suffused throughout both of them.
So how does this fantastical Russian village end up having some contemporary flavor, guys?
They bring some these two goons in the shape of John Travolta and Ari Gross into under the pretenses that they're going to open
in
a hippie
baggy mulleted shape of John Travolta and Ari Gross.
Are going to open a hot new nightclub in the middle of Nebraska.
A New York-style nightclub, as they say seven or eight times.
And hilarity quota is supposed to ensue, but never gets lost in the mail. It's amazing how far hilarity is from this.
I found it very odd that while watching The Experts, or as the title card eventually tells us, The E-Perts, because the logos are in neon and like the X gets like shorted out or whatever. I'm like, oh, it's The E-Perts. Again, it's like that sort of peak like low budget screwball comedy that like it feels like it's chasing about a million different trends at once.
Yes.
It's so odd, and it feels like it was a movie that could have only been released at the time it was supposed to be released. and then it came out in 1989.
The thing that's crazy is that like it was dated and unbelievably like fatally dated in 1987.
Yes.
So the idea of like we're going to put this on the shelf and then the world will change dramatically and the thing that this is about will end. Like like Soviet Union will no longer exist. Like, because I think, you know, I'm older than you guys, so I have more of a conception of what the Cold War was like and how there really was this idea that, you know, they were brains and they were cold and that they understood everything through books and through education and through, like, you know, wanting to destroy our country because they hate our freedoms. So again, I get the idea is like, well, how do you make them American? And you make them American by adding music, and you had finding free enterprise, and yeah, and it is
Japanese
kind of,
electronics.
It is kind of like Footloose, where they're like, oh my god, it's unbelievable how stupid everybody is here.
Well, that's
and again, there's yeah,
I don't understand what either of these two characters. Because I mean, the thing is, like, it's a really sweaty premise for sure. Yeah. Like, there's a lot going on, but like the idea is in aid of getting these two screwballs in screwball situations, but that never really happens because they're either too stupid or they're against each other, or like I guess Ari Gross is the neurotic one of the two, and like maybe John Travolta's dumb, but maybe he's not. Maybe he's just too sexy. It's very confusing.
Oh, I think he's very dumb.
Okay, all right.
I think it's established that John Travolta's character. Stupid. It's incredibly stupid. And I've actually seen this movie 3 times, which means I might have seen it more than Dave Thomas, the director. The first time that I saw it, I'm like,
you're an expert.
Unbelievably stupid. I'm insulted by how unstupid and implausible this movie is. The second time I saw it, for My World of Flops, God, this was like last year, I thought, this is even stupider than I remembered it being. And then now when I saw it, I thought, this is so incredibly stupid and implausible, and I kind of like it, question mark. Like, there's just this incredibly dumb, innocent charm to it that I didn't like experience the first 2 times. Maybe it's Stockholm Syndrome, but it's just kind of fun to watch John Travolta enjoy himself. The premise is so silly and ridiculous. Its take on the Cold War is – I mean, again, we watch two comic book movies, one created by one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, the other by, you know, a very talented guy, a very funny guy in Dave Thomas from SCTV, but a dude who was very much out of his element and had material that could not work under any circumstances, especially not the very unfortunate, very specific circumstances of being on a friggin' shelf until the world changed completely to render your premise completely irrelevant.
There's a lot of awkward transitions where it's like, we're just gonna, there's like scene missing, just move on. People will figure it out.
There are reels missing from this. Yeah, there are entire subplots and entire characters who feel like completely tacked on or completely missing. Like, I'm thinking, of course, of actor/producer James Keach, son of Stacy, as this like Russian pilot who gets jailed for flying in all of the Japanese electronics that they wanted him to fly in. But he gets it, and he's this womanizer, but like, he immediately gets on board with Travolta and Ari Gross and like becomes instrumental in their escape. And I'm just like, what is this? How does this fit into the movie?
Well, and Kelly Preston is the love interest in this. And
this is where they met, right?
Well, yeah, this is probably the best part of this movie, and that she's genuinely sexy. She genuinely has like great chemistry with John Travolta. There's a really fun scene where they dance together. And again, the premise makes no sense whatsoever. One of which is these people didn't know how to dance. And they never had any ex. And also, too, like, if they were Americans and the whole idea was to be American, why have they never experienced consumer products?
First of all,
like,
you cannot.
That's the essence of American life, is that you have a bunch of toaster ovens and microwaves and color TVs, and that's why you're better than everybody else.
You cannot undersell this dance scene. I watched it. I stopped everything. I paced around my apartment. I called my wife. I was like, you're not watching this movie, but you're watching this scene. Because it is so bizarre. Like, they opened this dance club. It's 80s nightmare. It's silver everything, and he asks, doesn't anyone know how to dance? And the world stops. She's like, I do. And we
record scratch.
Exactly. They're dancing around. She bites his dick at some point.
They're doing the lumbada, basically.
Yes.
He puts his finger in her mouth. They're like grinding. It's beautiful.
Oh, okay. And you see the other love interest in here. Do you recognize her, Mr. Worthington?
I did not.
That Deborah Furman from the motion picture Valley Girl.
Oh.
Yeah. Her career didn't go anywhere, as evidenced by the fact that she was the second female lead in this. And then in the third act, they make a break for it, and they decide to go to the United States, the homeland, the Mecca, where everything is perfect. And there's this very silly scene where they're called upon to renounce the United States. And they say, oh my God, here, I'm going to go look here. It says, let's see, America is screwed up. It stinks. It's pollution. And I would like to say on this podcast right here, I'm not being forced by this by the KGB. America screwed up.
Yeah.
It stinks. It's pollution.
Exactly. Yeah. they stop in the middle. Like, I just can't do it. I'm like, whether you're patriotic and B, you're totally right.
Yeah. Right. But no, I just love the fact that, because it's not only that they refuse to betray their country, but like the rest of the town stands up in support of them. They're like, you know what? Maybe spending decades being brainwashed into American consumerism, maybe he has a point.
Exactly.
We love our stuff. We love our someone literally says, like, we love our stuff.
Well, the stuff is they're like, oh, you know, they're never going to be able to understand what, like, the nightclub's not doing well. I don't even know what that means in these contexts, but it's not. And they're like, well, we need VCRs. We need all this stuff. And one of the things that is smuggled in, because John Travolta's character provides a list to Charles Smith. And one of the things Charles Martin Smith. One of the things on that list is a dildo. And he's like, we need VCRs. We need rap music, rock music, and dildos galore.
We need punk rock particularly.
Yes, exactly. And dildos, my God. Double underline on the dildo.
Yes, please. That's, if you can't get anything else, get the dildos. Exactly.
And then we haven't talked about one of my favorite characters, which is the black guy.
Yes.
Yes. The black Russian nerd is fantastic. I had so many questions about why he was there, why he was Russian, and what turned him around.
What,
it's so bizarre.
He has one of my favorite Seinfeld lines ever, which, I mean, it's a bizarre non-line, but it's when George is interviewing for a job, he's got the suit that's too noisy, and he wrangles the chef into giving the table food poisoning, and he doesn't want to eat the dessert. And the guy, it's this character, this guy just looks at him and goes, "If you're one of us, you'll take a bite." It's perfect.
Yes, it's beautiful. Well, let's talk about the clothes too, because I mean, I just, chef's kiss, the 80s fashions in this. Ari Gross, every single thing he wears, like the ascot and like the sort of Laura Dern salmon shirt.
Yes.
And those big ass baggy pants. It feels like Duran Duran threw up all over him.
Travolta looks like an alien hitman a little bit. Like, it's just a lot of dusters, a lot of black, a lot of white.
He looks like he should be hunting Hulk Hogan in Suburban Command.
Exactly.
Well, I feel like at this point in our culture, you had the worst of the 1980s and the worst of the early 90s.
So yes.
Kind of clashing up together into like this perfect storm of horrible hair, of horrible horrible fashion.
Travolta even proclaims
Travolta's mop in this.
He even screams out at some point, "It's almost 1990.
Yeah. Yeah, again, like that Duran Duran high shoulder padded jacket with like the cowboy boots. Oh my God, it's just
a lot of the jokes here is basically like Small Wonder, you know,
yes.
Where they'll be like, "I really enjoy this heavy metal music. It's great." What? You mean very metal that weighs a lot? You wouldn't be able to build bombs out of that. You're like, womp, womp, womp. And yeah, the black guy, Don Felt, is very excited to talk 1980 dated street slang.
Oh, that's
he's
right.
Like, "What a bees about blood. How's it hanging?" He's like, "It is hanging very well. Thank you for asking, my good sir."
I am AB positive.
Is what yeah. And then his arc, at the very end, he's like, he uses some black slang.
Yeah.
And John Travolta has succeeded in teaching this black man how to be black.
Yes. I do think that both Ari Gross and John Travolta, this movie would work a lot more or close to work if they were like 10 years younger, because they're in their like mid-30s, yeah. Man. It is a rough ride for this like rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, well, also, it would be different if they had different personalities.
Yes.
Instead, it's literally just character. Dumb and dumber. Like, one is really oblivious and thinks he's hip and cool and is actually a moron. And the other is really stupid and cool.
They have no
and is actually a moron.
They have no chemistry. The only thing they do is, like, fight each other occasionally. And it's that.
Yeah.
And it all feels so forced. Like, all their bickering, it just feels so writerly.
Mm-hmm.
I could never get a lock on like what Ari Gross was supposed to be different to Travolta, apart from being the shorter one.
Well, they're supposed to represent kind of the irresistible vulgarity of American life and capitalism. And I feel like they made a very poor case for what makes our country great. But there's kind of like an accidental honesty and candor to what makes our country owning a bunch of crap. That is all. Having a bunch of like a Sears, you know, a Sears catalog is all you need in order to be an American in 1989.
Right. And yet there's sort of a semi-woke moment that happens near the end where it's like, you know what, we're bringing, because they smuggle everyone onto a plane and there's a big action climax at an on a runway, as there was for every action movie.
Ironic quotation marks for action.
Yeah, action. But it reminded, I just kept thinking I was watching a really bad version of The Living Daylights, because there was like a big chase with Russians on a runway and a cargo plane. And they were like, hey, what are we going to do with all these people that are like bringing from Russia? And Ari Gross says, we'll just about everybody in America is an immigrant, or was at some point. Yeah. It's like, checkmate.
Well, it's amazing this movie doesn't know how to end, because they make this big moment of like, it's their Russian coming out party in New York City, and like it's the glitz and the glamour, and everyone's got two girls on each arm, and then they're like, well, this doesn't work.
They're going to be miserable here.
Exactly. I'm like, well, then how? And also, why did we do this? Then take them to Nebraska to begin with. I'm tired of this.
Yeah. It was so, it ends on such like a wet fart of, we're going to ship him on a Greyhound to hometown USA.
Yes.
It's so deeply terrible. but there is like a weird charm to it. Like there's, I don't know, for as much as Ari Gross and John Travolta have zero chemistry, I kind of appreciated that this movie didn't ask them to grow up at the end.
Yes. Yeah, I buy that.
Yeah.
Like they're just dipshits all the way through. And it's just like, we just have to accept it and learn from it. And it's just sort of like, eventually in a long enough timeline, their dipshittery pays dividends.
Well, they're American dipshits, which is the finest kind of dipshit.
That's the caliber of dipshit. The Cadillac of dipshits.
The rest of the world wishes they could be dipshits the way that we're a dipshit.
Right. Oh, man. And of course, it had that wonderful sort of 80s action comedy trope of like the supportive character. Like Charles Martin Smith gets shot in the shoulder or whatever. And I don't know.
Well, I love how Brian Doyle Murray is like the only dude who's like, we're going to get killed by the KGB. And it's like, yeah, dude, this is fucking serious shit. Like, we're gonna get hung in the town square, my friend.
There had to have been an easier way to do all of this.
And there's also this, the priest character, by that character actor, I have to look him up
Rick
now.
Rick Dukin from Heavyweights, I remember him from Heavyweights.
And from Burbs as well.
Yes, from the Burbs, yes, and also a little bit in Groundhog Day. Yeah, I can't think of, but who, like, they kind of try and make the real, like, they keep, like, passing the ball of, like, who's the silly heavy and who's the real heavy? And it's like,
yeah.
Yeah,
there's like a million bad guys, and I never know who's like the supposed to be the main bad guy.
Anyway, Rick Dukoman.
Dukoman, yes. Yes.
Right. So yeah, I don't know. There's just a lot going on, and yet not enough in The Experts.
I will say that you have to just seek. Don't watch this movie, but seek out. You can just type in The Experts dance scene and just watch that 5 minutes. Don't get.
Is it on YouTube?
It is on YouTube. I watched it this morning to reacquaint myself.
Oh, of course you had to, and you're going to watch it every day for the rest of your life.
Exactly. Don't watch the movie, but watch that scene. Don't get tricked into watching the movie either.
Well, yes. And we should also point out that at the end of this dance scene, John Travolta breaks the fourth wall to say, is this girl terrific or what?
Yes.
And then he later refers to making sweet love with her to, I popped her hood.
Yes. Oh, God.
Oh, gross. Like,
I was assigned to be your girlfriend. Now I'm assigned to blow your brains out. It's not great, Bob, but there's like a weird sort of anti-charm to it once you recognize how deeply stupid this motion picture is. Just as a time capsule of like both the 80s and the 50s, a movie that is out of time with every time period it's trying to be in, there's a weird sort of anti-charm to it.
Yeah, for the most part. And I definitely liked it a lot more the third time around than the first two.
What did turn it around for you?
Yeah, I would love to know.
I think it was just because I spent the whole first two times just being like annoyed at how preposterous it was and how unrealistic and how the plot made absolutely no sense whatsoever and how it wasn't funny. And this time I accepted that. I embraced it. I'm like, I don't care. I like that it makes no sense. I like that literally they could just like bring a Time magazine, and that would give them as much information as kidnapping two morons in violation of, like, the Geneva Convention and, like, risking their entire giant experiment, which, again, makes no sense whatsoever, solely for the sake of updating things a little bit. So, yeah, I embraced the stupidity, and I embraced the implausibility, and that made this a whole lot more bearable, if not necessarily, like, fun or funny.
Speaking of which, did they take that plane all the way back to America?
Oh, great question. Yeah, no, maybe they had to refuel in, like, I don't know, they
Switzerland or something. Exactly.
Clint, I think you found the one plot hole ruining this movie. Oh my goodness.
CinemaSins, ding.
Everything that's wrong with the experts. 73 minutes by Clint Worthington.
So maybe it's time to move on to Cage Match then. So between a failed, dated Dave Thomas Cold War comedy and a surrealistic nightmare from David Lynch, which is the better movie, you guys?
That's a really tough one.
Yeah. Have to ruminate on this one for a while. Let us know what you think, listeners.
This reminds me very much of that scene in Rushmore when Bill Murray is walking. He's on the phone with Schwartzman, and he's walking past this kid playing basketball and goes out of his way to reject his shot. That's what this is. It's a tiny child and Bill Murray. Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed watching Wild at Heart. I was disturbed deeply, as Mr. Lynch intended me to. I was confused deeply and actually also equally disturbed by the experts, which I don't think Mr. Thomas was shooting for.
Nathan, what about you?
I'm going to go with Wild at Heart.
Yeah, same here. There's not even really any contest. So yeah, congratulations, Wild at Heart, for winning our hearts. So yeah, we got a little bit of Cage news before we wrap up. We just learned that internet sensation Nicolas Cage is going to play internet sensation Joe Exotic in a TV series adaptation of internet sensation Tiger King. What are our thoughts on this? Because I feel like we may have a bit of a discussion here.
I don't necessarily need to see this as a narrative at all. I mean, it's unstoppable for sure. I also don't think he's right for the part. I think that he's insane and it's wonderful, and I'm sure Lord knows what this is going to look like, but I think that the Tiger King's energy, just the timbre of the voice, I just think it might be hard for Cage to get to. And maybe if he does a total Nicolas Cage and ignores that and just does whatever the fuck he wants, it might be interesting to watch.
Yeah, he's not somebody who disappears into his characters.
Yes.
His characters are Nicolas Cage. I mean, again, like, even there, like, when he's doing Elvis, he's Elvis and Nicolas Cage at the same time. And again, kind of my first response to this was, what a great coup for Nicolas Cage. Like, this is such a great role at this moment in time. And there are a lot of people who fucking hate Tiger King, both the character and the miniseries, and feel like it's romanticizing people who are terrible, who feel like it's very sexist, which I think is also pretty germane. And it goes on its way to sort of demonize this woman who's nowhere near as terrible as these horrible, horrible men. And yet, it's very, very complicated. The other thing that I find fascinating about Nicolas Cage as Joe Exotic is he's one of the Joe Exotics. Like, there is a competing project from Kate McKinnon in which he will play Carol Baskin. So there will be two going head-to-head against each other, which will be really, really fascinating. Also fascinating in that it will, you know, sort of consciously or unconsciously replicate the dynamic in the miniseries itself, where Joe Exotic and his competitors are literally willing to kill each other in order to get ahead. And again, I think just kind of like, well, this is great for Nicolas Cage because he's been having a hell of a comeback these last 4 or 5 years.
For
he's
sure.
Been in projects that people really like, that, you know, investing himself in it, and that this is something that will put him, if not like back on top again, something that will put him in the public eye in a way that he has not been since, I don't know, a decade or so. You know, so this is the whole big decline began about a decade ago.
Right. I think my position on it is, at first I was sort of excited because, you know, of course I'm a big Nicolas Cage fan, but I think whenever you're as deep into Cage lore as we are, you're always sort of having to contend with Cage the actor and Cage the meme. And it feels like casting Nicolas Cage as Joe Exotic feels more meme than man. where it just feels like it's, I don't know, it feels like Internet 101 expected to say, oh man, we should totally get Nicolas Cage. He'll be so crazy for this. And I think he's a more interesting actor than that. And also it disrupts my theory that Joe Exotic would finally be what gets Daniel Craig the Oscar.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's a perfect, because that's somebody that can disappear a bit and can get to that place. And I do think that the conversation about the Tiger King has been has become more and more dispiriting than the actual watch of it. Because I was like, oh, this is batshit. Everyone's a nightmare, and anyone who wants to cage an animal is terrible. And also the whole to your point, Nathan, the Carol Baskin thing, the meme of F Carol Baskin or whatever, and she's the only person, and again, she's not a great person, maybe she killed her husband, probably didn't. Sometimes that thing just follows you around. But that whole the meme culture of piling on the woman when this other guy literally shot tigers in the head for no good reason.
Yeah,
he's a horrible, horrible human being. And I think, sort of watching Wild at Heart is Nicolas Cage's character does horrible, horrible things. He beats a black man to death for 3 friggin' minutes. But because he's Nicolas Cage, because he's the hero, because he's the protagonist, because people have been loving him for 4 decades now, people are, moved to identify with those kind of characters. And that can be a dispiriting, very troubling thing. And I also like my Nicolas Cage. I did not give him for this role at all. I thought this is a Danny McBride role, or this is Thomas Lennon.
Because Danny McBride has already done a Joe Exotic thing on his TikTok.
Totally. And he looks like him. He can do the whole gay, gay flamboyant sort of. Yeah. I felt like those would be two much more natural ones. I'm not seeing Nicolas Cage disappearing. And on our Twitter thing, Travolta Cage, I said, well, who should John Travolta play in this? And people pointed out that he looks exactly like Jeff Lowe.
Yes.
Pictures are the same hair, the same face. That actually I think would be better casting, and it would be really interesting to see the two of them. It's also new to me that sort of John Travolta's last success was in a very similar project, sort of playing the O.J. Simpson.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Where he was pretty good, as long as you didn't, mind that he did not look or sound anything like the character that he was playing, which might also be Nicolas Cage here, where he'll be doing something interesting, and also he does not look or sound anything like Joe Exotic.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a really interesting project. I wonder how much that the Tiger King thing will remain in the public eye by the time these adaptations come out, because it feels like Tiger King was such a quarantine specific thing, because it was the first lascivious scandalizing thing that came out to occupy our brains and distract us from the fact that the country is dead. And we're all stuck in our homes. And it was the first big thing that we could all rally around and sort of communicate in a world where we can't see each other. So I wonder, by the time the months and years that this comes out, we're going to have to what it's going to even look like.
Yeah, I think we're going to be well over it by then. And I don't think, who knows? Prove me wrong. I think the McKinnon one probably sounds like it's more on task with what it's trying to do. This seems like A plus B equals money. So I'm curious to see what this looks like.
It also reminds me of the premise behind Army of One, which was also sort of a real life meme story that they turned into a crazy Nicolas Cage role.
Yeah, that movie was fucking terrible. That was just an abomination, and I really hope that that won't happen here. Although, again, you have, I think there were eight episodes. So you're going to really, really drag it out, and it'll be interesting what you were saying about it being kind of a period piece, even if it just comes out a year from now, because part of what makes this interesting is that the characters in that movie, their sense of style all comes from the 1980s.
Yeah.
That's all so tacky, so Florida. You're kind of talking about people who are already sort of lost in time and a time capsule. Yeah. And then when this comes out, I'm interested to see where our fascination with Joe Exotic is, because I feel like it's too white hot for it to not burn out. And people are like, well, why are they doing this? Because there's a fuck ton of money. There's hundreds of millions of dollars to be made from this. And Netflix has already made a fortune. So it will be interesting. And it also interesting that this is one of several really interesting, challenging, quirky roles in Nicolas Cage's future.
For sure.
Can't say the same about John Travolta. would love to have a conversation about a flashy new role he's in the for. But right, right, right. That just doesn't seem to be happening yet. But yeah, so I think we'll look and see. But it certainly is intriguing that our boy got such a big role.
I will say, if Jeff Lowe is played by Travolta, you have to do an episode-by-episode recap on this feed. You have to. You just have to.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, for sure.
Maybe we'll make
sure.
That a Patreon exclusive, because we should give them something.
For sure.
For our delicious buckaroos. So yeah, I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Steven, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you guys. Yeah, you can, if you're interested, we run a show called We Hate Movies at whmpodcast.com. We got plenty of stuff there. We got plenty of stuff on our Patreon. Check us out for fun, bad movie-esque kind of riffing. And thank you. And I've been a fan of you guys for a long time. It's really nice to be able to finally sit down and talk some Travolta Cage.
Oh, that is wonderful. And I also just want to say that you have been doing a hell of a job for the quarantine. You've been doing a project where you go through every single episode of Melrose Place and Beverly Hills 90210, and I have less than zero interest in either of them, and I've listened to every single episode.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah,
I absolutely adore them. And again, like I've said this before, we are kind of the model for how to have a great Patreon and offer lots and lots and lots of cool bonuses and engage with people constantly. So I cannot recommend We Hate Movies enough, and I cannot recommend joining their Patreon at least the $10 level.
Yeah.
For some reason, I've never been able to get the Glee glossary, and I feel like, you know, it'd be wrong to ask you. It's like the Tyde Perry had that great line about, you know, people like, oh, when's your show? Like, are tickets still available? It's like nobody like tweets that to Mick Jagger. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once again, thank you so much for listening to Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Wherever you do, leave us a rating and a review. It really helps us out. You can find us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can find Nathan on Twitter at Nathan Rabin, and me on Twitter at Clint Worthing. You can email us stuff at travoltacagepod@gmail.com, and you can support the podcast on patreon.com/travoltacage. Please do. It really, really helps us out. Thanks so much for listening, and now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go poo.